Fancy a game?
We're the only ones offering to sponsor the field, and we've got $62.
Whoa, you have $60?
Yeah, I stole it from you.
Technically correct.
You're right.
With Tyler Bischoff on ESPN Las Vegas.
The lane, lob to Shekna, didn't get all the way to the basket. He catches, kicks the ball out to Hamilton. Bryce's three is banked in. The Rebels never get that.
Fireball.
Hello, Fat Mata 2.0. We will have some updates on the UNLV coaching search. Bob Scucci is going to join us a little bit later. But UNLV did it. They won a close game. They won an overtime, actually a double overtime game. The other team messed up more in winning time than UNLV did last night. It was incredible. The end of the first overtime was amazing because Donnie Tillman's at the free throw line, down by one with 10 seconds left. He hits the first one. He's got a chance to put UNLV in the lead. 10 seconds to play. He misses the second one. Fresno State gets the rebound, and Noah Blackwell just throws the ball up the court off of Donnie Tillman's back. Like, Donnie Tillman was in great position, had no idea the pass was coming, hit him in the back. Amori Hardy ends up with the ball. He drives coast to coast and throws up the most wild floater you'll ever see, still with like 1.2 seconds on the clock. Like, he had plenty of time to just take a normal layup, but he decided, nope, I'm just flipping this one up for my hip, and he missed like everything. So it was the worst ending from both teams that definitely nobody deserved to win after the way that first overtime ended. The Mountain West should use that final 10 seconds to just promo Mountain West basketball for the rest of time. Just like, the Mountain West tournament's back in Las Vegas. Do you want to see this? It was glorious. Last night, though, UNLV got exactly what they needed to be a good Mountain West team. They got good games out of Bryce Hamilton and Donnie Tillman. Before that game, we find out Elijah Mitrulong has a broken left thumb and that he's going to be out 6 to 8 weeks. Elijah Mitrulong, he's second on this team in minutes. Elijah Mitrulong is second on this team in offensive rating. A team that's already short on depth, short on playmakers, and now they don't have the guy that T.J. Otzelberger has the second most trust in. Like, it's Amori Hardy and it's Elijah Mitrulong. That's been who he uses the most this year. That's not great. And if UNLV is going to win games, if UNLV is going to score points, they need other guys to have big offensive impacts, and the two most likely names behind Amori Hardy are Bryce Hamilton and Donnie Tillman, and both were excellent. Bryce Hamilton has been, in his career, an inefficient, high-usage player. He looks for a shot, but that's not, which isn't always a bad thing, but for him, his shot tends to be a mid-range jumper or missing a lot of threes. Last year, he was 29% from three. Entering the game last night, he was 7 of 27 from three. Last night, he wasn't extremely efficient last night. His first shot was a mid-range jumper off the dribble, but he had 21 points. He shot 3 of 8 from 3, 4 of 10 from 2, and he got 7 trips to the free throw line. He also led the team in rebounds with 14, and he had 4 assists as well. More importantly, he made some of the biggest plays in this game. End of regulation, UNLV's down by 5 points with 35 seconds to go. Marvin Coleman hits a 3, then Bryce Hamilton steals the inbound pass, and then Bryce Hamilton hits the game-tying basket in the final 10 seconds of regulation. Like, he made big plays in this game. Bryce Hamilton being an important player, Bryce Hamilton being a useful player, is huge news for UNLV if they can get something like that from him going forward. And then Donnie Tillman had a game-high 28. He lived at the free-throw line. He had 28 points on 7 of 15 shooting. He only took 15 field goals last night at 28 points because he was 13 of 19 at the free throw line. That is unreal efficiency. That is James Harden-esque efficiency. The two things they did with Tillman last night. First off, he killed Fresno State's zone. Fresno State went to a zone offense, and every time, every game, UNLV fans complain, oh, we've never had a good zone offense. You can't say that. They were great against Fresno State's zone last night, mainly because of Donnie Tillman. They got him touches right around the free throw line, and he basically used the same move every time. He'd take one dribble, pump fake, Fresno State defender would jump past him, and then he'd step around that guy and lay it in. He used it like 4 times last night, and they kept biting on the pump fake. He was great in that spot against the zone. Maybe the best play he made, though, wasn't scoring against the zone. He made that move and then kicked out to Bryce Hamilton for a wide-open three. UNLV's really struggled with the whole vision and kicking out thing this year. That's been one of their biggest problems on offense. To see Tillman do it at least once is a very good sign. The other way that he was very good is they used a horn set where two guys set a ball screen for Hardy. One rolls to the basket, one pops. He was the guy that would pop, he'd catch it, and then would drive to the basket. If you remember the Kansas State game, they basically ran that same type of play because Kansas State was going to switch it, and they were going to get a guard on Donnie Tillman. And Donnie Tillman couldn't beat the Kansas State guards. He just couldn't do it. He had a terrible game against Kansas State, got benched. Tonight, it wasn't them switching, but they liked the matchup that Donnie Tillman had. So, hey, here, go attack this matchup, and he actually won. So that's what they need from Donnie Tillman. If he gets an advantageous matchup, they need him to win it. He didn't do it against Kansas State. He didn't do it against Cincinnati. He did it last night against Fresno State.
Was his matchup shorter or taller?
Like, no, just not good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, there's just Mountain West. It's middle-of-the-road Mountain West teams. There's going to be bad players on the floor.
Okay.
It wasn't like, hey, they got a 6'1 guy guarding you. It was just, hey, you're better than that guy.
It just would be very UNLV to have a long, good player who is like, oh, my weakness, 6 foot tall player.
Yes. I cannot beat them. Put a 6'9 guy on me, no problem. I'm gonna dunk on that guy. 6'1? Oh.
He's down where I'm dribbling.
So you're not gonna get 28 and 21 from Tillman and Hamilton every night. Like that's not what's gonna happen. But you're going to need at least one of those guys to have a good game with Amori Hardy also playing well pretty much every night. And you probably need all three of them playing well to beat good teams. You're not going to have Elijah Mitre long for 6 to 8 weeks. Amori Hardy is going to be put under a lot of pressure as pretty much the only ball handler on this team. If you can have Tillman and Hamilton take some of that load off of Hardy, if you can have those two guys attack good matchups and be in the half court at least ball handlers for some parts of the game, that's going to be great. Tillman and Hamilton have shown they can do it. They can have good games. They can create quality shots in the half court. They just need to start doing it every game because now the margin for error is very, very small for UNLV. They need those guys to be good every single night. Also, with Elijah Mitre Long being out, it's a big blow simply because of depth. Just look at the lineup TJ Otzelberger was using in overtime. It was Hardy, Hamilton, Tillman with Shekna Dembele and Marvin Coleman. That was the overtime lineup that UNLV won a Mountain West basketball game with. Now, Mbaki Jong fouled out, so that's why Mbaki Jong's not in the game and Dembele is, but he could have gone to Nick Blair or Vitaly Scheibel. But Marvin Coleman's having to play big minutes now because they've got two guards.
I mean, we have to be impressed with Marvin Coleman, right?
Because of the one shot he hit?
He's shooting 50%.
From three or for everything?
No, yeah, from total.
Total.
He went 1 for 2.
Feed Marvin Coleman.
With four defensive rebounds.
He is shooting 100% in the final 30 seconds of games, 35 seconds of games.
He hit both his free throws.
He did. That's a big one. That's a big one. You can't yell about Marvin Coleman's free
clutch
throws. But what? Okay, the funny thing that they did, so Mbaki Jong fouls out in this game. And UNLV, for some reason, TJ Otzelberger decided that Shekna Dembele was the guy he was going to use. Nick Blair and Vitaly Scheibel, neither one of them had very good games. I would still think you'd want one of those two over Shekna Dembele, but Otzelberger went with Dembele. And the funny thing that they did is, on offense, they put Shekna Dembele in the corner out at the three-point line. Shekna Dembele has never attempted a three-pointer in his career. He's played over 70 college basketball games. He's never shot one. He's never going to shoot one. Like, but they put him in the corner as their floor spacer. Like, that's where Jonah Antonio would be. Is, hey, you go stand in the corner because if they help off you, you're going to hit a three. And it makes absolutely no sense to do that with Shekna Dembele because what Fresno State did, the guy guarding him just didn't go out there. He just stayed in the paint. It was like, all right, cool. Shekna Dembele standing at the three-point line. I don't care. But what actually ended up happening here is UNL, what Otzelberger wanted from Shekna Dembele was simply to stand there, and when somebody else shot, go get the offensive rebound. Just come sprinting in from the corner and get the offensive
like
rebound.
Like a wrecking ball.
Now, I still don't know if it's smart or not, because it's like you can't shoot. You're just clogging up the lane more. But when you're helping off of your man, you can't really block out. So Shekna, like, you couldn't block out Shekna Dembele because the guy guarding him is like 10 feet away. So it's like he can't really be blocked out. He only ended up getting one offensive rebound, so it's not like he came in and changed the game. But it's just, I don't know, it feels like you would never want that from your basketball team, but given the situation they were in last night, it's kind of like, all right, that's the best use of what you have on the floor, I guess.
Is it? It always feels strange to me that Nick Blair gets as many rebounds as he does, considering he's, what, 6'5"?
Works hard.
Oh, yeah.
Gets up under people's skin. Go grab the rebound.
So tired of that narrative. Here is my question, and it's the most important question to me personally. How many overtimes would have we needed to go to in order for Jay Green to pull off his breakaway pants?
Oh, all of them? What's the longest game in college basketball history?
I'm on it.
Because, like, Otzelberger, he wasn't even going to use Vitaly Scheibel or Nick Blair. Like, he was dedicated to Shekna Dembele standing in the corner on offense. So he was not going to sub. I guess I feel like if one of the guards, Hamilton or Hardy or Coleman, had fouled out, they would have still gone to Blair or Vitaly Scheibel. So you might have needed like four guys to foul out before Jay Green gets in the game.
In 1981, Bradley played Cincinnati, and the game had the most overtime periods, regardless of NCAA classification, with 7.
Ooh, 7. It's a good one.
That's
so 8. And Jay Green would have gotten in the game. Technically correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
It only ended 75-73.
Oh.
7 overtimes.
Some great offense. Technically correct is brought to you by Boyd Gaming. The Orleans has a free rodeo event starting today, running through December 15th. Orleans Arena is hosting All In Barrel Racing. It's got free admission. Starts at 9 a.m. every day. So if you're looking for a cheap way to get into the rodeo, head to the Orleans Arena. Technically correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from beconnectedsports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at beconnectedsports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Jake Bischoff scored his first goal of the season last night.
For the Chicago Wolves, here is what it sounded like on AHL TV.
Finds Coughlin at the point. Steered over his partner, Bischoff. He'll let it go. A stop by Pickard. It goes in. A screen by McKenzie and a blast by Bischoff. And the Wolves, with 16 seconds remaining in the first, have drawn first blood.
Jake Bischoff now has more goals in professional hockey this season than Nick Hague, John Merrill, and Derek Engelin combined.
Poor Pick.
Why poor Calvin Pickard?
I don't know. Just every time I was just like, we were all in on him.
You think he was wearing his Picks mask?
this like, I don't know. I feel like we like sort of made him disposable.
Who's we? They have definitely made him disposable. Like
this town, I don't know. Like
exactly what the Golden Knights did with him is made him disposable. They claimed Malcolm Subban off waivers before the first game. That absolutely made Calvin Pickard disposable.
Yeah, exactly. All right. We're on the same page.
He is the definition of disposable.
Is Derek Engelin playing better?
Yes, he's going to score a goal soon.
I know. No, I wasn't completely done with my question.
Oh,
was
you just
it?
Stopped
Does
for
it...
5 seconds for no reason?
No, I was clearing my throat. Does it make you scared of what they're never going to bring up Jake Bischoff, despite the fact that he actually does score goals?
Oh, no, it doesn't matter what Derek Engelin does.
Oh,
Derek Engelin's a lock. They're not doing anything to get rid of him. I got to hope that Nick Hague is terrible or John Merrill or Nick Holden is terrible.
Well, so far, he seems pretty good.
There is mutual interest between UNLV and Marcus Arroyo and Morgan Scally.
That is according to the Review Journal's Mark Anderson. Arroyo, the offensive coordinator at Oregon. Scally, the defensive coordinator at Utah. Arroyo's 39. He made $825,000 at Oregon this past season. Scally is 40 and made $825,000 as well. At Utah, they're both in that usual Desiree Reed-Francois age range for head coaching hires, both making less than $1 million. So if UNLV actually can pay more than $1 million for their head coach, conceivably that would make sense for them as far as getting a pay bump to go be a head coach somewhere. But what is more important? A lot of people did not either pay attention or learn anything during the UNLV basketball coaching search. The same person who reported that Thad Matta was a done deal to be the next UNLV basketball head coach reported yesterday that Graham Harrell, USC's offensive coordinator, was interviewed by UNLV, only for Mark Anderson of the Review Journal 4 hours later to say no, Graham Harrell was not interviewed by UNLV for the head coaching position. There are actual reporters with actual jobs for actual media outlets that have actual ramifications if they report something that is wrong. Listen to those people. If it's not if it's not coming from somebody that works for the Review Journal or the Las Vegas Sun or like a well-known national college football reporter, don't believe it.
I mean, I literally made this joke yesterday, whenever Grimala was on, and I made him say of these three candidates that are none of those are candidates. But this one is the most interested, and I literally tweeted it out, and people were like, oh man, Jay Gruden, really? And it's like, no, what is wrong with you people?
Jared tweets it out, it's not true.
Exactly! Don't take me seriously.
John Gruden is hopeful to have Hunter Renfro back for the Chargers game.
So that would mean he misses the next two and then plays in the last two against the Chargers and the Broncos. If you remember, he has a, punctured lung because of a fractured rib. Not great. But he could be back for the last two games of the year. I'm curious how they handle him with regards to the season. Like, if they lose to the Titans, their playoff hopes are pretty much over. Do you really bring Hunter Renfro back for the last two games?
I mean, you made your number one, or you made your first round pick tackle play through a severe leg injury.
Yeah.
Yes, you bring him back.
I would like to think they'd say, no, sit this one out. But if they beat the Titans and beat the Jags, they've certainly got legitimate playoff hopes for the last 2 weeks. Then if he can play, absolutely, because the Raiders wide receivers haven't been very good.
You're flexing and all y'all broke-ass haters. Walk up in the club, it's a tight money army. $100 bills, ain't no damn change on me. Lil Tay, you're ballin' in the IA. I dropped 200 racks on this car. And I'm only 9 years old. I got the keys to this car.
Tay-Tay's stat of the day.
Over the last four games, Dolphins kicker Jason Sanders has more receiving touchdowns than all Raiders wide receivers combined.
Good God.
The Raiders have not had a wide receiver catch a touchdown since November 3rd against the Lions. In those four games, there have been three passing touchdowns from Derek Carr. Two have been to tight ends. One has been to a fullback. You can also throw in that Dolphins punter Matt Hack has as many passing touchdowns over the last 2 weeks as Derek Carr. There's a lot of fun stats when you only score 12 points over two games.
Wow! All right.
Marc-Andre Fleury is back with the Golden Knights.
They play tonight in New York, 4 p.m. start. Ryan and Frank are down at Twin Peaks on Eastern, so their pregame show starts at 3:30 if you want to go down there and watch the game.
Get a hug from Frank.
Despite Fleury's return, Malcolm Subban is starting, according to Gerard Gallant via Jesse Granger's Twitter account. Fun fact, though, Malcolm Subban, last five games, 4-1-0. on the year, 9-2, not on the year, last five games, 4-1-0, with a 9.26 save percentage. This is not his best five-game stretch as a Golden Knight. Last year, he had a five-game stretch where he was also 4-1-0 with a 9.31 save percentage. And if you go back to the first season, he had a stretch where he was 7-0-0 with a 9.13 save percentage. And I tell you all of that to say Subban has looked very good recently. I don't think there's any reason to think he's good to go now. Like, I'd be a little hesitant on the, oh, Subban's finally putting it all together as a professional goalie in the NHL, because we've seen this from him, and then usually it's injuries, but injuries and inconsistencies still come back to haunt Malcolm Subban. He doesn't do this for an entirety of a season or even an entirety of his workload in a season, which is 15, 20 games. So a little hesitant to say he's putting it all together, he's good to go, because we've seen this before.
Why do you, like, I always see the donut, and all you ever see is the hole.
Well, the hole has a bunch of facts in it.
I'm just asking for, you know, a little. Come on.
He's been great.
He's putting it all together. Just say, like, he could be putting it all together.
He could be putting it all together.
Thank you.
Colorado State and Mike Bobo mutually parted ways.
Normally, the mutually parted ways stuff is kind of crap, but Brett McMurphy tweeted that Colorado State's buyout to Mike Bobo was negotiated down from $5.5 million to $1.82 million. So Mike Bobo, getting fired by Colorado State, they owed him $5.5 million, and he agreed to only take $1.8
million. This, like, was it one of those things where, like, when you win the lottery, you either get X amount per year,
or a lump sum.
Or a lump sum.
The only thing that makes sense to me,
he was going
to
get 10 grand for the
I don't, and I haven't seen any actual details on it, but the only thing that makes sense to me is if he had a contract like Marvin Menzies, where UNLV owed Menzies a buyout, but as soon as he took another job, he forfeited the buyout. UNLV does not have to pay Marvin Menzies anything anymore because he took another job. So maybe that was in Mike Bobo's contract, that if he took another job, Colorado State did not owe him any more money. So instead of taking $5.5 million over the next, whatever it would have been, 3 years, he takes, I'll take $1.8 million now and I can go find a job right now and it doesn't affect how much you owe me. That's the only thing that makes sense on the Mike Bobo end. Otherwise, he's just giving away $4 million because,
as you do.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. My question, though, three Mountain West jobs open now. Colorado State, New Mexico, UNLV. UNLV, better than New Mexico?
Yes.
I think so, too, but not better than Colorado State.
Nope.
So what I hope happens, and I doubt that we'd actually get the public details, I hope all three of them try to get the same guy. Like, oh. I hope there's one coach that gets offered by all three and he gets to pick.
All right, so we already have sent Ed Graney to follow DRF's husband around the Dakotas. How do we
track Colorado State's coaching search?
Well, how do we track what Power 5 coordinators are flying to New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado? So,
yes, this should be actually easy. You need a flight tracker that goes to Albuquerque, Fort Collins, and Las Vegas. That's a pretty unique trio right there, simply because of Fort Collins and Albuquerque. Lots of people come to Vegas, but the other two is like, all right, this plane left from Eugene, Oregon, went to Fort Collins, now to Albuquerque, and is now in Las Vegas. All right, we know it's Marcus Arroyo.
So someone else needs to get on that.
Absolutely. Skip this one. Go to the last one.
All right. Gerard Gallant has only challenged two goals this season.
The NHL corrected a flaw that they had in their review process this offseason, because in the past, you could challenge goals for offside or goalie interference. But for some reason, if you lost an offside challenge, you were given a penalty. But if you lost a goalie interference challenge, there was no harm. Like, you just lost the challenge. There was no penalty assessed to your team. Well, they changed that this year to where if you lose any challenge, you are given a penalty, and the result is significantly fewer pointless challenges. Take Gerard Gallant as an example. Last year, he challenged a goal every five games. This year, he's only challenged two plays in 30 games, so he's challenging every 15 games. at this point. But the reduction of challenges is just, we're simply not wasting time anymore. Because like last year, Gerard Gallant challenged 5 times for offsides. He won 4 of them. So basically, he only challenged for offside when he knew. He's like, all right, we know that's clear and obvious. That's offside. We're going to challenge that one. But he challenged 12 times for goalie interference last year. He only won 2. Now, some of that is because the goalie interference rule is subjective and offside is black and white. But Gerard Gallant even said it last year. I'm just going to challenge things that are close because nobody knows the rule and there's no harm to it. Now you get penalized if you miss that, so there's less challenges that have no chances of getting overturned. It's great.
Game flow.
Although, actually, I like challenges, so maybe I should take everything I said back.
I thought you specifically liked when the ref skates to the center.
Yes,
and
that,
goes,
yes, I like that
goal!
Part. Yes, I very much like when the referees make it about themselves when announcing the result of a challenge.
Why don't we just make it every single time there's a goal? It's not a goal until the referee skates to center, center ice.
He has to shush the whole crowd. Shh. We got a good goal. Coming up next, Bob Scucci will join us from Boyd Gaming. I want to ask him about Josh Shaw, the Arizona Cardinal DB that was on IR, getting busted for betting on the Cardinals.
Blast by Bischoff.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Time to get an update from the sports book with Bob Scucci.
How much? How many extra points is Gardner Minshew's mustache worth?
I'm giving it 2.5 points. I really like it, and I'm a big Minshew fan.
Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Bob Scucci from Boyd Gaming joins us. Bob, what do you make of the situation with Josh Shaw, who is an Arizona Cardinal, but he's been on IR all season, hasn't actually been with the team? What do you make of Josh Shaw betting on NFL games?
Well, I mean, it's such a rare instance. I probably wouldn't make too much out of it. I mean, all the leagues, the NFL, all the professional leagues, the NCAA, they do a great job in educating all the athletes to stay away from gambling. And there's nothing to indicate that he did anything to kind of influence a game. Like you said, he's been on IR all year. So I think this is a kind of a one-off, and it's such a rare instance. But there's certainly going to be more focus on things like this as we move forward and more states legalize gambling, sports gambling.
What's the actual casino or sportsbook role in stopping or tracking players' betting? Like, is there anything you can even do about it?
Sure. I mean, we can refuse bets. The thing of it is you have to know who the individuals are. So, I mean, it's incumbent on us to kind of do our due diligence, but obviously there's no way that we could know who every single person that walks through the casino doors is. You know, if they have a player rating card, obviously we could, you know, we'll know their name, we'll know who they are. But in some instances, they could just be anonymous. They walk into a strip casino, and unless somebody knows who they are, it'll be difficult.
Well, like, to me, this is a good example because, like, of course, if Tom Brady walked in to place a sports bet, I think people might recognize him. But who is Josh Shaw? Nobody knows who Josh Shaw is. Like, there's plenty of NFL players or guys that are on IR or whatever it is that nobody's going to actually recognize them walking into a sports book.
No, and they're certainly not going to recognize the family members of the players or the friends of the players. And, I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. But it doesn't mean that the casinos aren't going to, like I said, do their due diligence. Everything that we're able to do, the casinos will certainly do.
Is California going to get legalized sports betting soon?
Well, they're pushing for it. I saw some of they're going to, California likes to put things on the referendum and let the voters decide whether or not they want it. So it looks like it might go to a referendum, and then I think the voters will have a chance to have a say in it.
Would you be surprised if the voters, if it does go that far, that the voters of California, if they said yes to it?
I think I wouldn't be surprised. No, I think every state is kind of looking to new kind of revenue streams and ways to kind of boost or bolster the state budgets. I think a lot of them are probably, you know, a little over anticipating the amount of those dollars, but nevertheless, it's still money that they don't have now. So I wouldn't be surprised. I think the key, though, is really mobile wagering, and I think some of the conversation has been surrounded surrounding just at racetracks or casinos. And I think the key in getting those big numbers like we saw in New Jersey and Pennsylvania is getting mobile wagering.
I keep asking you this question, but after two blowout losses, are the Raiders any good?
Yeah, they're not really that good. They're better than a lot of people expect it, and they're competitive, and they still have an outside shot at a playoff spot. They're actually playing the team this week, Tennessee, that is ahead of them. They're just behind, I think, the eighth spot, behind the Tennessee Titans and Pittsburgh Steelers, who are both 7-5, and Oakland at 6-6. You know, they really need to have a couple of big wins against these teams that are just ahead of them in the playoff picture.
Wait, are they home underdogs, Tennessee?
They are, yeah.
How many points?
Well, they're getting 3 points. We opened 2.5. The professional bettors have absolutely loved this Tennessee team going back to the game against the Kansas City Chiefs. And Tennessee has put together 3 straight wins against the Chiefs, the Colts, and the Jaguars, and the professional bettors are riding this team. Going into this team, they love them again this week, so a lot of money on Tennessee.
You're always telling me not to overreact to one game, but how much do you overreact to the Raiders losing back-to-back games by 31 points each?
Well, that's the key, is back-to-back. Like I said, anyone could kind of slip up in one game, and when you start getting into 2 games and 2 decisive losses, you know, you look at a loss like the San Francisco 49ers against the Ravens. It was a great game. You know, there's nothing wrong with that loss as compared to kind of a blowout loss. You got the two losses are not equal. So, yeah, the Raiders' 2 blowout losses certainly go down in the ratings.
Does the fact that the Raiders have scored 12 points over the last 2 weeks, does that factor into the total at all?
I mean, we still have a pretty high total at 47.5. I think the circumstances surrounding some of those games, I think the Raiders are trying to shorten the game a little bit and run the ball. So it does. I mean, again, you take 2 or 3 games in a row, and when you get a lot of low-scoring games, you gradually start decreasing the total in the next games.
With that wild card race for the last spot in the AFC, it's going to be Pittsburgh, Tennessee, and maybe the Raiders could be in there. Neutral field, though, between those three, which one of them is the best in terms of the odds?
Well, like I said, Tennessee is probably the hottest team, but Pittsburgh's coming up pretty well, too. I still make Pittsburgh the top team, Tennessee second, and Oakland third.
All right. If we look at the NFC, 49ers at Saints, but who right now is the favorite in the NFC?
It's probably still the 49ers. Like I said, you can't really take away too much from them in that loss against the Ravens. The losses that they do have were really good, close games that could have went either way. I still love this defense on the 49ers, their offense. They love to kind of spread the field, throw a lot of intricate plays, confuse the defenses. It's really an impressive team. So they're still the favorites. I think, you know, we had to make New Orleans a slight favorite in this one, only because of the real strong home field advantage. We made them a 3-point favorite. All the money is on San Francisco. We're down to 2.5. And I don't blame the betting public. If they're able to get the best team in the NFC and they're able to get a couple of points too, we kind of anticipated this one coming.
We also have the Chiefs at the Patriots. Who are the Patriots still second best behind Baltimore in the AFC?
Yeah, but they are they're showing some vulnerability. You know, the Patriots are 10-2, but a lot of those wins were against some real bad teams. You know, the Redskins, the Jets twice, the Dolphins twice. They're not exactly the elite teams that they're beating up on. And the elite teams that they did play, like the Texans and the Ravens, they lost to, and they had a real close game against the Bills. So the Bills are actually climbing up in the AFC rankings. Behind the Ravens, I think the Chiefs are behind the Ravens, and probably New England third and Baltimore fourth.
Now that they've made the switch, how big of a favorite are the Jacksonville Jaguars this week?
The wise guys have been betting against the Jaguars every week, and again, this week the Chargers are a 3-point favorite. We're pretty close to going to 3.5. So Jacksonville's at home, a 3-point underdog, and they're not looking too good as of late. The sharp guys have been betting against them every week.
So no Minshew bump, huh? Weird.
No, yeah, the 2.5 point Minshew mustache bump.
Serious question. How are you dealing with the Jets at this point?
They're a tough team to handicap, and I'm not real comfortable with them being a six-point favorite against the Dolphins. You know, the Jets' signature win was against Dallas. Then they faltered a couple of weeks where they played poorly, but then they got kind of right back into things, the blowout win against the Raiders. But the Dolphins, you know, as bad as they were the first half of the season, they started playing competitive, and they're one of those teams that keeps kind of sneakily covering games, you know, as big underdogs. Winning the game outright as almost double-digit favorites twice this year, winning the game outright as double-digit underdogs, I mean. And then here the Dolphins are getting 6 points. That's a tough one. I don't feel too great about having the Jets such a big favorite.
So you're going to, man, you're going to be like have acid indigestion while watching a Jets game this weekend?
You know, as with all the bad teams that I've watched, you know, that's one of the things about being a bookmaker in Vegas or anywhere else is that you have to root for a lot of bad teams all year long. So nothing new there. Some of our biggest decisions are on bad teams. So nothing for me to watch two bad teams.
UNLV basketball won a game in double overtime last night. They have now had 4 of their 10 games go into overtime, one of them into double overtime. Are you guys going to start putting up props for UNLV games on the over-under of minutes played in the game?
Yeah, no, we'll put up a three-way prop, though, you know, like who wins the game and then whether it goes into overtime.
I'll do it like soccer.
Yeah, like soccer. You know, we'll put up the three-way prop. You know, this team A wins, team B wins, or there's a tie in regulation.
You'd actually be doing pretty well if you bet UNLV to tie in regulation in all their games this year.
No kidding. I've never seen anything like this with so many games going into overtime. At least they were on the winning side of this one.
Finally.
I mean, the last few, they were on the losing side.
So one other game last night was Purdue and Virginia, and the final score in that one was 69-40, 109 total points. What did you guys have the total on for that game last night?
I want to say it was about 140, something like that. I mean, it went obviously way under, but yeah, it was a low total to begin with. Actually, no, you know what? I take that back. I'm thinking of the other game. It was a real low total. We opened that one at 102.
Oh, it went over.
Yeah. We closed it at 103, and it actually went over. So we did a pretty good job on that one.
So, you have, like, Virginia. They play, I think they're the slowest team in the country this year. And obviously they play Purdue, who's also pretty slow. But, like, Virginia's had games where, like, they played Maine and gave up 26 points. They only gave up 34 to Syracuse. Is it possible that Virginia plays a game this year and the total is under 100 points?
It is possible. I mean, yeah, I mean, we get 102 against Purdue. When they play a team that they can just smother defensively, and they're not going to put up a whole lot of points. boy, that would be interesting now that you mention it, because I can't remember the last time we had a game under 100.
I mean, we're kind of used to Virginia being slow and very good defensively, but this year seems like an extreme, because I'm just looking at it. I think the two previous games before Purdue, neither of the totals would have gone over 100 points.
Right. I know. So we're slowly getting there. So I'll have to look at their schedule and see which teams they have coming up next. But it's very possible. Yes.
Last one for you, the Golden Knights. They're playing tonight in New York against the Islanders. How do you handle Malcolm Subban right now? Because he's a backup. Normally there'd be drop off if he's in there instead of Fleury, but he's 4-1-0 in his last 5 games and has like a 9.26 save percentage.
Yeah, you know, we're just kind of looking at the trend there. We actually have the Islanders a slight slight favorite in this one. The money's really slowed down on Vegas, both with the professional bettors and kind of the general betting public. So it's not like the game is going to be like a big decision like it was kind of earlier in the year or last year. It's not going to make too much of a difference, like you said, that now that they've been playing with them. A little bit of money coming in on Vegas, but not much.
Well, he is Bob Scucci with Boyd Gaming. Bob, as always, we appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Bob.
Malcolm Subban can be a superstar and still not get the recognition. That's the real question. How many wins until Malcolm Subban is treated like Marc-Andre Fleury at sportsbooks? What are we doing next?
That's what I'm asking.
Let's see. Tony Sanchez, did he leave? Here's the question. A lot of people think he's left UNLV in a better spot than when he got here. Not so sure.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Tyler Bischoff is
Technically Correct, the best kind of correct.
No fans were arrested after the fight at the end of the UNLV-Nevada game. Nevada Sportsnet reporting that. Was any of that arrest worthy?
I mean, no. This wasn't even like, was this even the biggest like brouhaha that had broken out at a UNLV-Nevada game?
No, apparently not. But you have helmet ripped off by a fan.
You have helmet returned to fan.
Fans throwing water bottles and snowballs. One fan did jump into the pile. I don't know what happened to that guy, but he did jump into the pile. I don't know. Like,
what is your thought process? They're wearing armor, yes. And they're mad.
Yep, I'm going to take them down. I don't know. It doesn't. To me, it doesn't jump out as, yes, that's arrest worthy. Although maybe we should arrest somebody just simply for hitting Cassie Soto with a bottle.
Oh yeah, no, that we're taking that person behind the woodshed and we're gonna rough him up.
So Tony Sanchez, he took over UNLV when it was at one of its lowest points at the end of the Bobby Houck era. If you listened to the UNLV Nevada game on television, they kept saying Tony Sanchez is leaving a lot of talent for the next head coach. They listed off three players when they said that. Charles Williams, makes sense. Kenyon Oblad, all right. And Courtney Reese. I don't know why they mentioned Courtney Reese. He had 11 carries all season. But if we just look at on the field, off the field, of course, getting the practice facility built is like one of the best off-field accomplishments of a UNLV coach ever. But on the field, UNLV right now is ranked 120th in S&P Plus. That's 120 out of 130 S&P Plus, the efficiency ranking for
top
college
125.
Football. For reference, 120th is the second worst ranking for UNLV football over the last 15 years, which is as far back as S&P Plus goes. Bobby Houck, 122 in his last season, was the worst. So technically, he did improve from 122 to 120. But Tony Sanchez had actually taken the program from one of its lowest points all the way up to 106 in S&P Plus in his fourth year, right? He'd improved every year, was actually on the right trend there, but then this year was really bad. Just came all the way back to basically where they began. So I don't know that UNLV's in a good spot for their next head coach. Like, I don't think the roster's that great. You look at the game against Nevada, only two seniors are on the offensive depth chart. Both offensive linemen. But, like, are we convinced Kenyon Oblad's going to come back and be anything better than a below-average quarterback? Charles Williams, if he comes back, he had a really great season. The Tony Sanchez era kind of proves great running backs don't lead to bowl games. The offensive line was good, but not great, and you lose two guys there. And then the wide receivers struggled for the majority of the season. You had some breakouts here and there, but for the most part, they didn't do anything special. I don't know that the offense was that great. They were ranked 111th in S&P Plus. So it was returning a bunch of bad players from a bad offense that good. I don't know. And then the defense was 113th in S&P Plus, and they lose their three best players. Javon White's gone, Rashad Jackson gone, Jericho Flowers gone. Like, the only three guys that made impact plays pretty much the whole season are all gone. So I don't think it's correct to say there's a lot of talent left over for the next head coach. I don't think that's accurate.
They're not starting from zero.
That is true. There are actual players on the roster. When Sanchez got here, there weren't a lot of players on the roster. So he did elevate it from no players to some players. But I just don't know. Like, sure, you can say the practice facility is going to help the new coach, whatever. I don't buy that argument a whole lot, but it helps. I just don't know that on the field, talent-wise, UNLV's in some great spot for the next head coach to take over. And you look at the recruiting class, it's, you know, there's 11 players in it, but you definitely need another 10 to 15 before you can call that a great recruiting class. So Tony Sanchez didn't do a terrible job, but I'm not sure the next head coach is truly set up for success.
Tyler, you're a bitch.